The third and final case set for oral argument on today's calendar is case number A19-1677, the State of Minnesota versus Jennifer Lynn Baldwin. Both attorneys are experienced advocates before the court, so they know that each has 15 minutes of argument for their principal argument, and then appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 15 minutes of rebuttal argument. Counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and your client and begin.
Thank you. May it please the court, I am Sarah Martin. I represent the appellant, Jennifer Baldwin. Ms. Baldwin was convicted of second-degree murder in connection with the death of a 9-month-old who had been dropped off at her house shortly before coming severely symptomatic. The only significantly contested issue at trial was when the injury occurred. Ms. Baldwin raises four issues on appeal, and today I'd like to address the first two in the briefs, the trial court's denial of a continuance and ineffective assistance of counsel. These errors on the part of the trial court and counsel left Ms. Baldwin without an expert at a trial that should have been a battle of experts. She was prejudiced by not having a defense expert and asked this court to reverse her conviction. The trial court abused its discretion by denying Ms. Baldwin's request for a continuance. The state points out that there are no cases directly on point, and that's true, and that illustrates just how much of an outlier that this case is. There has been no case where the defense, through no fault of their own, has a critical witness become unavailable shortly before trial and the court denies the continuance request. But that's what happened here. 2 weeks before trial, the defense learned that its expert, Dr. Evan Matthews, was hospitalized and would not be able to testify for trial. Dr. Matthews was going to testify about the critical issue of when the child's injury occurred. This evidence was...
Good morning. I just want to clarify the record as to Dr. Match's situation. He was hospitalized in May, as I understand it. And what is the evidence concerning his unavailability? In other words, it appears from your affidavit that he was... that was filed with the post-conviction petition that he was out of the hospital in June, that he had some communication with the defense team on June 3rd. So it's not entirely clear to me that the record that he was completely unavailable on June 10th to testify in any manner or to provide any assistance at all.
At the time that the defense made the request for a continuance, it was unknown, and that's what Mr. Gordon explained to the court, that he did not know how long Dr. Matches was going to be unavailable. I know from talking to Dr. Matches that he was he had limited availability after he got out of the hospital. And he also had a number of other cases, that he had. There were a lot of moving parts as far as his scheduling. But as far as the information in front of the court at the time that Mr. Gordon made the motion for a continuance, it was unknown how long he was going to be unavailable.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but Mr. Gordon didn't ask for a continuance of a week or 2 weeks or any particular period of time. Is that correct?
That's correct. Mr. Gordon, again, did not know how much time was going to be needed. And at the time that he was making the request for the continuance.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Martin, in my review of the papers that were filed, the motion and the response letter motions, essentially, and the transcript of the hearing, I was struck by it was extensively litigated by the parties and it was thoroughly reviewed and discussed by the judge. You know, I mean, I was expecting maybe more of a quick ruling, but I mean, the Judge Anderson really spent a lot of time, I think, letting the parties argue. And it was a nuanced, both parties had nuanced arguments. I mean, given our standard of review, and it seems to me that when it comes to matters of trial management, case management, the abuse of discretion standard may be even, you know, at its height. But I mean, why did Judge Anderson abuse her discretion in the way that she considered the motion and ruled on the motion? I mean, in light of my, you know, the features of the motion and the hearing that I'm referring to.
Judge Anderson abused her discretion because this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court have articulated factors that should be considered when deciding whether to grant a continuance request. And those four factors are the reason for the request, the prejudice to the non-moving party, any continuances previously granted, and the timing of the continuance request. The reason for the request, this is a requirement to show good cause. And the defense did this in this case. The defense explains that Dr. Matches, who was a critical witness for the defense, was unavailable. He was unavailable due to illness. It was not any fault of the defense. This court in Strobel has stated, and that's a speedy trial case, that ordinarily unavailability of a witness is good cause for delay. The next factor, prejudice to the state, there is none. The only factor that the state cited in this case is that the family was invested in the prosecution. And even assuming that is a valid factor for the court to consider, it certainly does not outweigh a defendant's constitutional right to present a defense.
But Ms. Martin, if I could stop you there on that one, I mean, that we do have case law that talks about the prejudice to the state. And when we say prejudice to the state, we're not just talking about this ephemeral entity, but we are talking here about victims, the parents, the family that is waiting to have the trial and anticipation of it, very unfortunate anticipation, and having delays and not getting that resolution is something that courts look at. And here, the district court, as Judge Johnson pointed out, the court, you know, extensively listened to the arguments of the parties. And one of the things that the district court was troubled by was the fact that there wasn't a date certain by which the witness would be available. That uncertainty of not knowing when the trial is going to happen, is it going to be a week? Is it going to be a month? Is it going to be a year? Why isn't that at least a factor that would favor the state in that analysis?
I would agree that that is a factor, but regarding the fact that the defense didn't know how long of a continuance would be needed, it really wasn't reasonable for the court to expect the defense to know at that point in time, just given the circumstances of the case.
But there wasn't any follow-up from defense either. The defense could have come back and said, a week or two later, hey, we found out he will be available by this time. There was never any further communication.
That's correct. I guess that kind of gets into the next issue of ineffective assistance of counsel. But to the point of what the court could have done at that point, the court could have done any number of things. The court could have ordered the parties to come back on the trial date granted the continuance, ordered the parties to come back on the trial date and provide information about when the witnesses would be available. The court could have set a scheduling conference out a period of time. And at that point, the parties could have determined when and the witnesses would have been available. This would have allowed the defense to find out when Dr. Matches was going to be available. And if Dr. Matches wasn't going to be available for an extended period of time, it would have allowed them to contact another expert, have them review the case, and determine when they would be available to testify. But what the court can't do is deprive a defendant of the right to present a defense and have them go forward to trial without a critical witness in the case. And this error was prejudicial. To illustrate just how prejudicial it was, I think that the state's rebuttal argument, starting at page 1653, is key. The state says, Mr. Gordon has just argued to you that at some point on the morning of March 15th, Colton was injured, had some kind of a head injury that was mild and became severe. Is there any evidence? Did anyone testify to anything like that? Did any of the doctors you heard from say that's a possibility? That would be very convenient, but nobody said that. And the reason that the state was able to make this argument in rebuttal was because the defense did not have an expert of their own.
Ms. Martin, on that issue, I guess at the time of the hearing on the motion to continue, I think one of the state's arguments was that the it was in the letter brief that the defense had been talking to multiple experts. And so I think the argument was made to the district court that maybe I misunderstand that denying the motion for continuance would not leave the defense without any expert whatsoever, and that was the argument. I mean, was that argument made, and was that the understanding, or could that have been a reasonable understanding of the district court when ruling on the motion?
The state made that argument, but Mr. Gordon made very clear that Dr. Matches was their expert that they were intending to rely upon. So there were not any other witnesses available to them. There were no other witnesses that really helped them through this process of developing a defense theory, of honing their defense theory. They did, Mr. Gordon did speak with Dr. Uphoven earlier, but that was just an initial review. That was before they'd even gotten all of the information. And then she had referred them to Dr. Matches' group.
Counsel, though Dr. Matches was part of a bigger group, the NAA, and it doesn't appear that the district court judge asked whether someone else from that group could testify, I believe. And yes. And I believe counsel indicated that no one else was available, but didn't provide much of an explanation. So, you know, how did the district court abuse its discretion when there wasn't much of an explanation as to why this group as a whole wasn't available?
Mr. Gordon simply stated that they weren't available. They were not the people that reviewed the case. They were not the people that were intending to testify. I don't know that it's realistic for him to get the schedules of every single other person at the group and find out where they're testifying. But any other witness from that group would have had to do the same thing that Dr. Matches had to do, which is review all of the information and then clear the schedule in order to testify. And it's simply not reasonable to expect some other person to do that on such short notice. That's just not how things work with expert witnesses. The process is fairly long, which is why it's important to get started early in the process.
I think it'd be helpful to talk about the prejudice prong some more too. You know, I think in addition to the circumstances surrounding the request for the continuance, the appellate courts must determine whether a defendant was so prejudiced in preparing or presenting a defense as to materially affect the outcome of the case. And I know you mentioned that, I think you mentioned that earlier, but here, you know, the focus was on the timing of the incident that caused the death. And there was testimony from a variety of different doctors about both the ability of a child to compensate and a broader possible timeline. So how is that prejudice standard met given that, you know, the state's own evidence reflected the points that Ms. Baldwin was hoping to make with her own expert?
I think that the cases, especially Beecroft and Aki versus Oklahoma, make the point very clearly that the defense is entitled to their own experts to present their theory of the case. And when the theory of the defense is that the state's expert is wrong, you need your own expert to present that defense. The defense is not going to be able to effectively do this through cross-examination, no matter how skilled the attorney is.
But Ms. Martin, if I could stop you there, case law does recognize that a defense counsel can either admit their own witness or basically try to poke holes in the state's witnesses and can rely solely on cross-examination. And here, as you acknowledge, for example, Mr. Vaughn and the district court acknowledge that there is effective cross-examination to show that the window wasn't just by the people who actually examined CS, that the injury could have occurred within hours, within 3 to 5 hours. And so those experts acknowledge that the time frame could have encompassed any of the other people that had been with and handled CS prior to the 911 call.
I would agree with that. And I think that that shows just how important Dr. Hudson was to the state's case. All of these other witnesses provided a wider time frame for the incident. So the conviction likely came down to Dr. Hudson. So it was extremely important for Ms. Baldwin to be able to address that testimony. Thank you.
Judge Johnson, can I ask a follow-up or two?
Yes, you may.
Well, a follow-up to my previous question, I guess. Thank you. Ms. Martin, I think you said, you know, that BCROFT stands for the proposition that defense is entitled to present its own case and that they need their own expert to do so. Are you suggesting then that it's always an abuse of discretion for a district court to deny a continuance where the request is made because an expert is unavailable for some reason?
Not in every single case. And Barnes is a good example of that. In Barnes, the expert was going to testify about really an inconsequential aspect of the case. So that would not be an abuse of discretion. So what the court needs to do in these cases is consider all of the facts and circumstances, including the centrality of the expert testimony. And in this case, the expert testimony was clearly central to the case. Every element of the case was proved by it, and the court abused its discretion by not granting the continuance.
Is there any evidence in the record to suggest how Dr. Matches would have what testimony he actually would have provided, that he would have provided favorable testimony?
It is my understanding that Dr. Matches had not completed his entire review of the case, but what we do know is that he would have provided favorable testimony about the timing of the offense.
And what are you basing that on?
Based upon Mr. Gordon's testimony at the post-conviction hearing, based upon Mr. Gordon's argument at the hearing in favor of the continuance, and on the affidavit of counsel filed with the post-conviction petition, which is document 170.
Thank you.
Judge Johnson, if I may ask a follow-up question.
Yes, you may.
Thank you. Ms. Martin, I actually want to follow up and get some clarification on a question that Judge Cochran asked. You said that the expert would have testified as to favorable timing. And I'm curious as what do you mean by that? And would that quote unquote favorable timing, would that have been consistent with the three experts for the state who did examine CS, who said that the time frame of the infliction of the injury could have been within 3 to 5 hours?
It would have been consistent with that. The state was able to poke holes, I think, in that testimony by its questions about, you know, would a child with X injury be able to do various things? And the witnesses all said no, they would not be able to. Dr. Matches could have testified more clearly and more effectively about this concept of a lucid interval where the child is injured and then at a later point becomes severely injured or severely symptomatic, which is precisely what the defense theory was and what the state argued effectively in rebuttal argument that there was no evidence of at trial.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. Thank you for answering our additional questions, and you will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client, and you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brittany Lawan, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota. I'd like to start by pointing out some an answer to Judge Reyes, your question with regard to whether or not the testimony would have been cumulative to what the other witnesses testified to with regard to the window. If you look at the transcript of the evidentiary hearing, if you look specifically at page 22, Ms. Martin asked the question of Andrew Gordon if he believed he would provide helpful testimony, if the doctor would. And his answer was, I certainly hoped so. It's not he would, it's I hoped so. There is no evidence in the record that they had obtained a favorable expert opinion. And it was a hope. He also says on page 21 that he had been given a hint or a preview of his opinions. There is nothing in the record establishing that there would have been testimony from the doctor that would have been anything more than cumulative at this point. Additionally,
so Mr. Counsel, yes. Just to follow up on that, and I was going to ask Ms. Martin about that as well, but we ran out of time. There isn't an affidavit from Dr. Matches in the post-conviction file. And so there isn't any record of what he would have actually testified to. Is that accurate?
That is accurate, Your Honor. And it's my understanding in looking at the evidentiary transcript that Mr. Gordon did not have Dr. Matches finish the report. He never ended up finishing his review of it. So I don't believe that that would be available at this point. However,
and is there any indication? It's my recollection that there isn't any indication as to when he would have been available or if he would have testified at a later date.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I'm not seeing anything in the record that would reflect when he would have been available. The continuance hearing transcript, which is the May 30th, 2019 transcript, also has Mr. Gordon admitting and agreeing that he would, that the state's witness would provide some of the information that he was hoping to put forward. Looking at page 8 of that transcript, he says, I think Dr. Nelson, who did treat the deceased child in this case as a potential alternative witness, I believe that's accurate. Hopefully, if he were to testify consistent with the information in the police reports and the medical records, we believe he would testify that the timeline of this injury seems to exclude Ms. Baldwin from being the individual who caused this child harm. That's exactly what the testimony was. So at the time the district court was making the decision about whether or not to grant the continuance motion, Mr. Gordon agreed that the information he was seeking to present would likely be available. Additionally,
counsel, you know, I think appellant makes a good point that there's a difference having your own expert testify than being able to cross-examine the state's experts or witnesses, medical witnesses. So why can you address the argument as to why appellant wasn't so prejudiced as to materially affect the outcome of the trial by not having appellant's own witness testify?
Yes, Your Honor. It is true that it would be nice if each side had an equal number of expert witnesses, but that's not what the law requires and that's not the standard. Not all experts are created equal. There are times where an expert witness can be put on and be impeached so badly that they actually damage a defendant's case. So sometimes it's a tactical decision based on what the testimony is going to be as to whether or not to call that expert. And here, there's evidence in the record that there was a robust challenge in cross-examination. I believe Mr. Vaughn did a very robust cross-examination, and I think the district court post-conviction order analyzes that and acknowledges that.
Ms. Lawan, I want to follow up on that because defense counsel wasn't asking for, you know, four experts to counter the four that the state presented. They were only asking for one. And in reviewing some of the case law, I realize that there's not a ton of case law directly on point on this issue, but the they cite a case from the Supreme Court for I forget Michigan or Ohio, something like that, the Ackley case. That one seems Michigan. I think that's a Michigan Supreme Court, and they actually found on the ineffective assistance of counsel that the attorney failed the first prong of the Strickland test because they did not call any witness to support the theory that the child, and that was a very similar case. State had several medical experts who testified. The defense did not call any. And the Michigan Supreme Court said that failed the first prong of Strickland analysis. Why shouldn't we look to that? And that seems factually very, very similar to what the situation we have here.
Your Honor, first, that decision is not binding on this court, of course, because it's outside of Minnesota. I'd also note that the cases are different because if you look at the cross-examination that takes place, that defense theory was still presented. And it's not, I do agree, it's not as if they were asking for four expert witnesses to testify. They were asking for one. But this is not a case in which that was the only defense attempt that was made. There was a motion to dismiss for lack of probable cause. There was a motion for a Fry-Mac hearing. There was a motion for funding from the district court, which was granted not once, not twice, but I believe three times, at least twice, with regard to obtaining an expert. And so here, the testimony at trial allowed for a question of the timing of the injury. And that was put forth through the experts who actually examined the child. They aren't necessarily state witnesses in that sense. I mean, the state put them on. The state has the burden to prove each element, but they're not hired experts in the sense of a state's expert witness testifying to a conclusion at the detriment of a defendant. They're testifying as to what the examination showed and what they believe. And so here, I just think it's distinguishable from that case. I would also point to the deference that we give to a district court, especially on post-conviction review, in looking at the credibility determinations that were made, as well as the district court's conclusion with regard to the prongs of Strickland. Here, the district court, in hearing the testimony from defense counsel and reviewing the entire trial record, concluded that Mr. Gordon presented not just an objectively reasonable defense, but far above an objectively reasonable defense. This was not something where defense counsel didn't cross-examine witnesses, didn't put on a defense, didn't put on a robust closing. This was thoroughly litigated, as Judge Johnson recognized, in even just the motion for a continuance. The parties were very invested here, and the record reflects that. And I think the testimony at the post-conviction evidentiary hearing and Judge Conroy's explicit findings with regard to that and her conclusions support a decision to affirm the denial of post-conviction relief.
On the ineffective assistance of counsel prong, shouldn't the focus be on the absence of any follow-up by Mr. Gordon as to the availability of Dr. Matches and other potential witnesses from NAA?
I think that's something to consider, Your Honor. And in the district court's opinion, the attorney didn't give enough reason for a continuance. But that alone doesn't equate to ineffective assistance of counsel. There might have been reasons why he didn't follow up with further information. Perhaps he did not have information, he didn't have a finished report, and maybe he didn't want to share more of his trial strategy. To be frank, the transcript of the continuance hearing shows even more being disclosed by the parties, I think, than is usual with regard to each side's preparation and things of that nature. So I think it doesn't amount to ineffective assistance of counsel simply because he did not follow up and provide more information.
To demonstrate prejudice, assuming there was some ineffective assistance of counsel, just hypothetically, would appellant need to show that Dr. Matches or some other expert would have testified at a later date if the continuance was granted to show prejudice?
I think that would be helpful because of the high burden for prejudice. I don't know if it's automatically required, but here, that would have been the only way to even get close to surmounting that high burden. If this court were to look at the language, I believe it's Richter versus Harrington versus Richter, talking about how the standard of whether it's reasonably likely that the result would have been different, it's not just if it's possible or if there was no effect, but quote, it must be substantial, not just conceivable. That's the standard for prejudice. And that burden has not been met here when there is no evidence of what that testimony would have been.
On the issue of prejudice, I guess I want to understand the entire state's case. I didn't see this in the briefs, but maybe I missed it. Did the state call both parents and the family friend who also cared for the child that morning, and did all three of them testify, you know, in essence, I did not do it?
The state called, I want to check the transcript to make sure I'm of that. I know that Miss, I believe all three testified, but I want to verify that. So if I can look while I keep answering questions, I just want to verify that.
Well, maybe. I don't want you to have divided attention, but do you know that some of them testified?
I do know that they testified, and I do know that there were denials.
Which ones?
I believe Miss PG did. I can check because the index will have the names of the witnesses, and I just want to make sure I'm not inaccurate. Yes, both parents did testify, and additionally, yes, all three did. All three individuals who had contact with the child before the fact of, before he was dropped off at the defendant's residence. Also, the state did do a very thorough investigation of the timeline of when the mother drove the child, trying to account for every single minute leading up to placing her son in the care of the defendant. Further, there was also an admission from the defendant, I believe 4 months after the child died, that she handled him roughly that day. So there is an inculpatory statement at that point.
And that came into the record how?
Yes, that did. That came into the record through the testimony of, I believe, one of the detectives who had interviewed her. And I can find the citation to that in my brief. But she does make that admission at some point. And that was after she never made such an admission on the 911 call. She never made such an admission at any point when speaking to the investigators about what happened, trying to piece things together. She never did it until about 4 months later.
And in her statement, did she elaborate on what she means by treated him roughly, or how she treated the child roughly?
I'm going to point you to the transcript pages because I want to make sure I'm not misrepresenting it. I have it down as transcript pages 15, 12 to 13. And 1485 to 1490. And so I believe it was admitted to handling him roughly and aggressively before she noticed a change in the responsiveness and consciousness. And that statement is pretty significant, especially given the timing of it. It wasn't as an attempt to help treat him or anything, it's after the fact.
Ms. Lawan, I want to turn to the fourth issue in this case, and that's with respect to the aggravating factor and the upward departure. And as an element of the offense of second degree murder while committing a third degree assault of a victim under four. And the child here was, the child victim was 9 months old. And so it seems that the charge already takes into account the young age of the victim here, of CS's young age, and the Muhammad case that is discussed by both, I believe by both parties, does not really seem applicable because that involved a statute that said 18 years or younger. And the district court's rationale of the vulnerability would seem to apply for a child under 4 years old, which is very different than, for example, a child that's 18 or 17 or 16. So this doesn't seem to be applicable. The Muhammad case doesn't seem to be applicable to this one at all.
Your Honor, respectfully, I disagree. I think that there is a difference between a child who's 9 months old, who can't speak, who can't move, who can't walk on their own, and someone who's three. There's a stark contrast in someone being particularly vulnerable if they can't defend themselves. They can't cry out. If they can't say anything, if they can't try to scamper away. I would agree, of course, that an infant is much different than an 18-year-old here. But if you look at the statute and the underlying statute on the sentencing transcript, the district court is explaining its rationale for why it kind of rejects the argument that appellant makes here and that was made below, that you couldn't use this as a departure ground. That the statute separates the underlying assault when the victim is under the age of four because it has to do with the level of damage and the level of harm done to the child in order for it to be a felony. And here it's a lower amount because the child was under four, because the child can't protect itself. But that doesn't mean that the conduct here was not more significant. I think the jury's finding and the district court's affirmance of that with the Blakely factors is sufficient because of the particular vulnerability of this 9-month-old boy who was in the care of a caretaker, who is the one who ultimately caused him harm. The sentencing transcript on page 51 is where the district court speaks with regard to that. So that would be something that I would point this court to. Also, I do believe that, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, Turbitz and Beard would be helpful here. I discussed them in our brief on pages 43 and 44. And the sites for those would be 830 Northwest 2nd, 173. That's where a defendant pleaded guilty to second degree felony murder with an underlying felony of child endangerment in the death of a 19-month-old he was babysitting. And a departure was affirmed on that ground. Additionally, in State versus Beard, a daycare operator was convicted of second-degree felony murder in the course of committing third-degree murder of a five-month-old in her care. That's 574 Northwest 2nd, 87. In that case, this court modified the more than double upward departure back down to a double departure. Here, we don't even have a double departure. It's only 75 months. I see that my time has expired. I would just respectfully ask that this court affirm the district court's denial of relief and affirm appellant's conviction.
I apologize. Thank you, Ms. Lawan. Ms. Martin, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to jump to the prejudice prong of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. In Kimmelman versus Morrison, which is the United States Supreme Court case, the court said that the essence of an ineffective assistance claim is whether the error so upset the adversarial balance between the parties that trial was unfair and the verdict was suspect. That's what happened here. Ms. Baldwin was on trial for murder, facing a sentence of more than 20 years, and the state's case was proved almost entirely through scientific evidence, and the defense had nothing to rebut it because of the mistake that they made and that didn't allow them to have an expert. So they had no expert to help them.
I think I just heard you say that there wasn't an expert because of a mistake made by the defense. Now, assuming we were to agree with that, is there any evidence in the post-conviction proceedings to demonstrate that Dr. Mathis would have actually testified? I don't see that. That's where I guess I'm having trouble.
There is some information, brief information about what Dr. Mathis would have testified to if he had been called in the affidavit of counsel. As the issue related to funds makes clear, we're in a little bit of a catch-22 situation in this post-conviction proceeding. I didn't have funds to secure a witness to testify, an expert witness to testify, because that was denied by the district court on grounds that they don't apply, that the statute doesn't apply to post-conviction proceedings. So I was not able to have an expert come in and say all of the things that they would have said. I was not able to retain someone to go through all of the records in this case. What I did do was get some basic information from Dr. Matches and Dr. Wigrin and provide as much information as I could. That is also the reason that I went to outside Minnesota, and there are numerous cases from jurisdictions around the country where this very same issue has come up, where defendants have trial without an expert in cases involving abusive head trauma or shaken baby syndrome. And what those cases and all of those articles make clear is the substance of what an expert would have testified to. It makes clear that there is a very vigorous debate in the medical community about the diagnosis of abusive head trauma. And it makes clear that expert testimony from defense witnesses on those issues can be persuasive.
Thank you.
I would like to address one point about Ms. Baldwin's statement that has been characterized as an inculpatory statement. This was, I believe, either the third or fourth statement that she gave. She gave several lengthy statements. And she does say at one point that she might have picked him up abruptly, but she did not think that that injured him. And this was really in the context of investigators stating that the child was injured in her home. They knew that the child was injured in her home. And she explained that nothing happened in the house. She had been with him the entire time, except for when she had been getting him a bottle and was briefly out of the room. She explained that she did not shake the child, she did not throw the child, and that she would not hurt a child. Her admission is really limited to this idea that she might have picked him up more abruptly than at another time. So it is not inculpatory to the extent that she admitted doing something that would have hurt the child.
Did she use the word roughly with respect to her own conduct?
My recollection, and it's in Exhibit 82A, is that she picked him up abruptly. I would just turn this court's attention to Beecroft, which stresses the right to present a defense theory through its own witnesses. Ms. Baldwin had a right to do that in this case, and either through an error on behalf of the court by not granting the continuance, or by defense counsel for failing to present enough information to get that continuance, she was deprived of that right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. Thank you to both attorneys for your excellent arguments on a difficult case. The appeal is submitted, and the court will issue its written opinion within 90 days. Thank you. And with that, we are now in recess.